Peter B. Collins. News and comment. It's Friday, February 19th, 2016. The United States launched an airstrike on Libya overnight, and I take it as the first salvos of our new war on Libya. Mid-80s music from a San Francisco band called Looters. The tune is War Drums. American warplanes struck an Islamic State camp in Libya early Friday morning, targeting a senior Tunisian operative named Nourdine Shushana, who we're told was most likely killed in the strike, according to the Pentagon. The airstrikes on a camp outside Sabratha, about 50 miles west of Tripoli, killed approximately 41 people, in addition to the targeted individual. Now, according to the New York Times, these airstrikes come as the Obama administration and its allies are considering increased military action against this alleged growing threat from Daesh, the Islamic State, in Libya. But I believe that this is just the opening round in what will be a new front against another Middle East country. And the U.S. is not only acting as the world's policeman, but in this case, executing a man who was wanted by Tunisia. So we are Tunisia's policemen, too? I'm a little troubled by that. Now, this is interesting because the first citation was of an unnamed Pentagon official, and then it shifts to an unnamed Western official with a capital W. And the Western official said that the airstrikes did not represent the start of a new major American war in a Muslim country. But frankly, I call bullshit on that. The jets were Air Force F-15Es that took off from a base in Lochinheath, England. The next paragraph tells us, special operations forces using reconnaissance drones, satellite imagery, and other surveillance equipment began monitoring the site, a walled compound, several weeks ago. So we already have boots on the ground in Libya. There's been no debate. There's been no discussion about a return to the country that we blew up several years ago and destabilized by tossing out the dictator who kept things in check there, Muammar Gaddafi. And there is little response that I've heard so far from any elected official or other leader in the United States. This is just Obama war business as usual. Ho-hum, another country. We don't ask questions about potential blowback. And this is all under the umbrella of fighting terrorism. According to the New York Times, Tunisian and Libyan officials have in recent months warned that jihadists operating around Sabratha represented even greater threat than the Islamic State's Libyan stronghold in Sirte, which is the oil town on the coast of the Mediterranean. And they argue this is because Sabratha is a strategic point on routes for smuggling men and materiel from Algeria and Tunisia into Libya. But it is amazing to me that our perpetual war conditioning, this is the new normal. We just accept, you wake up in the morning, Obama has struck another country. We don't need messy, you know, debates. We don't need to hear the pros and cons. We don't have to operate under the Constitution and declare war. No. We just sit back and trust our government that it's keeping us safe. Meanwhile, in Syria, the war continues, and there was hope that today would be the announcement, not of a full ceasefire, but of some cessation of violence. Hasn't happened. Not likely to. The one positive development this week is that there have been deliveries of humanitarian aid to seven areas that have been under siege across the nation of Syria. And it's interesting because the way The Guardian frames this story, is that it's now down to direct talks between the U.S. and Russia. They quote the U.N.'s Syrian envoy, Staffan de Mistura, who told a Swedish newspaper, "We need real talks about peace, not just talks about talks. Now the Americans and Russians must sit down and agree on a concrete plan on the cessation of hostilities between today and mid-next week. Now the ball is in their court." Now there is an interesting, and this is reading some tea leaves, but a minor shift in the position of Russia, articulated by its ambassador to the United Nations, Vitaly Churkin. And he was responding to an interview that Assad gave just before talks in Munich over the last few weeks, in which Assad pledged to retake his whole country and appeared to rule out negotiations. And the Russian Churkin said, "If they proceed on the basis that no ceasefire is necessary and they need to fight to a victorious end, then this conflict will last a very long time, and that is terrifying to imagine. Syria, quote, is already on the brink of falling apart." Meanwhile, the situation has gotten more complicated because of Turkey's troubled alliance with the United States. We claim Turkey is an ally, but as I've pointed out repeatedly, it's got its own agenda. And instead of taking on the Islamic State, it has been busy attacking Kurdish fighters both inside Turkey and in the Syrian and Iraqi war zones. And pivoting off what may or may not be a real attack by terrorists, because the Kurds are flatly saying they did not cause the explosion that killed a whole bunch of people in Ankara, the Turkish capital, when a military bus was hit. 6 soldiers at least were killed. Now, the Kurds adamantly deny any role in this bombing. But that doesn't stop the Turkish government led by Erdogan, who is trying to use the Kurds as a wedge between the U.S. and Turkey. And, of course, the Kurds are the only reliable fighters on the ground in Syria and in parts of Iraq, from the U.S. perspective. And so do we need the Kurds more than we need the Turks? That's a difficult choice. But Turkey wants us to make that choice. Are you on the side of Turkey or its enemies? And this is what makes this whole problem so complicated and so difficult to resolve. And the U.S., which has condemned the attack in Ankara, said that they aren't sure who's responsible. It's premature to assign that. And Turkey has been shelling the American-backed Kurdish militia, known as the People's Protection Units, or YPG, in the northern portions of Syria. Not only that, you've probably heard the U.S. has asked Russia to refrain from air assaults in certain zones where we either have special forces or we are supporting and supplying some of the various insurgents in Syria. Meanwhile, here stateside, the battle over iPhone encryption continues, and the New York Times has 2 front-page stories today that provide a fascinating look at the evolution of Apple's position. One of the things the government has said is, hey, why are you standing on principle over the San Bernardino phone? Because over 70 times before, Apple has relented and accepted court orders to open up iPhones. Well, the Times does a good job of showing not only the evolution of Apple's stronger encryption software in the phones, but also the shift from Steve Jobs to Tim Cook after Jobs got sick and died, and Cook is now firmly in control of the company, and he has a much stronger, much more aggressive position on encryption. And so while I've heard a lot of people who I consider to be ill-informed and unaware of the bigger picture here and the dimensions of a back door, if the government achieves that, other than the issues that I have with the slave labor in China and the tax dodging in Europe by Apple Computer, I think that this is a very important battle that is shaping up. And when you look at the history, a few years ago, Apple started to get more restrictive about accepting warrants and other demands for customer information. And so a couple of years ago, they started to tighten up the software with OS 7, 8, and number 9 is the one that has the encryption that appears to be unhackable. But over that period of time, Apple started to require law enforcement officers to come to Cupertino, where an Apple engineer would go into a SCIF, that's a secured compartmental information facility, a dead room. And so they tried to make it more difficult for law enforcement to engage in this process of unlocking phones. And in at least one case, law enforcement officials rushed a phone to Apple's headquarters for unlocking, only to discover that the phone wasn't locked to begin with. Now that's pretty stupid. And it shows that the government believes that it should have unlimited powers. And the arrogance of that, not even attempting to open a phone before they sent it to Apple to hack it for them, I think is an interesting example. And one of the things you should know about is that Apple has been routinely cooperating, and in the San Bernardino case they did as well, in giving the government, in exchange for a warrant, access to any iCloud storage, photographs, documents, videos, that you may have that's linked to your account. And I have very intentionally not used any cloud storage systems. I do use some transfer systems that store some of the information, but I don't consider that to be secure or private information. But I don't turn on the location device on my phone, and I don't store anything in the cloud. Because, you know, there isn't actually a cloud. It's just an image. It's a bunch of servers somewhere. And those servers can be opened up to the government with a court order. So I find this very interesting, and I want to continue to encourage my listeners to support Apple Computer here. It's interesting, the New York Times editorial today is very strong in support of Apple. And it cites a 1977 case involving the New York Telephone Company where the U.S. Supreme Court said the government cannot compel a third party that's not involved in a crime to assist law enforcement if doing so would place unreasonable burdens on it. Well, I think Apple has made it clear that creating new software to allow the FBI to hack into a single phone would make all phones vulnerable to that kind of hacking in the future. So I'm glad to see that some smart people are recognizing this. In California, Dianne Feinstein, our senator, is all in favor of government access, doesn't want to offer any security. And Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren from San Jose, who's on the House Judiciary Committee, she has come out fully in favor of Apple's position. Now, what about the tech companies here in Silicon Valley? Well, it's very interesting because the WhatsApp service, which is owned by Facebook, the leader of WhatsApp, whose name is Jan Koum, tweeted out support for Apple, saying, "We must not allow this dangerous precedent to be set." But behind the scenes, there are companies that are involved in what's called the Reform Government Surveillance Group. And some of those are uncomfortable with Apple's strong position. Now, one makes a good point. This is Gunter Oilmann, chief security officer at Vectra Networks in San Jose. He said, "I'm concerned that since Apple has attempted to deny the FBI request, citing use of back doors, should they lose this legal argument, the repercussions could be extensive to the entire security industry." Yeah, but acquiescing or finding some third way out of it would only delay, in my opinion, that day of reckoning. Now, one of the other interesting points is that Apple is not as eager for government business as Amazon, which has the big cloud deal with the CIA, or companies like Google that have deep connections to the federal government and the surveillance state. So I think this is going to be a very interesting battle, and we will continue to advocate for our privacy rights here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. Now, I did ask, you know, the gods, the universe, to make sure that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders were asked about the Apple case in the sequential town halls. It was just 1 hour interviews that were conducted on MSNBC last night by Chuck Todd and Jose Diaz Ballard. And it was interesting because neither one took a clear position. Sanders said, when asked, whose side are you on? He said, both. I am fearful in America about Big Brother, and that means not only the federal government getting into your emails or knowing what books you're taking out of the library or private corporations, knowing everything there is to know about you in terms of your health records, your banking records, your consumer practices. On the other hand, what I also worry about is the possibility of another terrorist attack against our country, and frankly, I think there is a middle ground that can be reached. I don't agree with that, Bernie. I think you're talking out both sides of your mouth there. And honestly, I don't think there is a middle ground. Technologists refer to this idea as the magic pony solution. And that's where Hillary goes. She called the situation a difficult dilemma. She discussed the main concerns Apple has about the back door and that that could be abused by authoritarian regimes like the Chinese, Russia, Iranian governments. But then she went to the magic pony angle. As smart as we are, there's got to be some way on a very specific basis we could try to get help get information about crimes and terrorism. And, of course, almost all the Republicans think that Apple is in the wrong here. Rand Paul, who exited the race a while back, is one of the few Republicans who had a different view on that. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins podcast with your subscriptions. People like Joe Clarici, Brian Mazzi, Andy Krieger. And let's see what's on the next page here. David Rabin, who just renewed his annual subscription. Thank you, Dave. So I want to thank each and every one of you and encourage you to continue to support my work. And I need you to help me recruit some new subscribers here to keep the revenues up and keep it all working. I have had some drops in revenue over the last month or two. And if you can help out, now is a good time. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, then click on Become a Subscriber. And if you're a new annual subscriber from anywhere in the continental U.S., I have two bonus books for you to choose from. The new one is The Burn Pits by Joe Hickman, and we just released our in-depth interview with Joe yesterday. It's a powerful book, and I highly recommend it. The other option you have is Ben Parker's fun little book called A Field Guide to the F Word. Either one can be yours. All you have to do is sign up for a new annual subscription at peterbcollins.com. And, of course, we're continuing to raise money for NewsBud, the 100% people-funded independent news outlet. And we have 710 contributors as of today, up to $67,000. Our goal is a lofty one, $950,000. We have 54 days to go. So please spread the word. Go to newsbud.com or just go to kickstarter.com and enter NewsBud in the project window. Either way, you'll be able to watch the short video, get full information on the plans, and I hope that you will support it and also share the information with your friends and your networks. Glenn Greenwald has a great piece at The Intercept today, picking up on comments that Bill Clinton made on Monday at a secret no-press-allowed event with roughly 100 leaders of South Florida's Jewish community. The Times of Israel said that Clinton vowed, if elected, Hillary would make it one of her top priorities to strengthen the U.S.-Israel alliance. And Bill also stressed the close bond that he and his wife have with the state of Israel. And Greenwald notes that Bill Clinton's vow of even greater support for Israel is completely consistent with what Hillary herself has been telling American Jewish audiences for months. But it also implies criticism of Barack Obama, which she has said is disloyal, when Bernie Sanders does it. Hillary has said, I have stood with Israel my entire career as Secretary of State. I requested more assistance for Israel every year. I defended Israel from isolation and attacks at the United Nations and other international settings, including opposing the Goldstone Report. Now, the Goldstone Report accused Israel of war crimes in the 2008 assault on Gaza. And so what is very clear is that the Clintons believe that they can win support of Jewish American voters by promising even greater allegiance to the extreme government in Jerusalem. Hillary has said in her first month in office she would invite Netanyahu to visit. And so we really need to make this very clear, that Hillary Clinton represents a new phase of America subjugating its foreign policies to the interest of this radical government in Israel. And to be fair, Bernie Sanders does not distinguish himself on these issues. Now, he is nominally Jewish, but is not really observant. He has long viewed Israel favorably, but he's far from radical on these matters. He is, at least according to Greenwald, more willing than the standard Democrat to express criticisms of Israel, but he generally doesn't discuss this, and no foreign policy issues came up that I heard in the discussions in Nevada last night. Now, we've got a lot of partisan problems here in the United States, but it hasn't gone this far. In Kosovo today, opposition lawmakers released multiple canisters of tear gas on the floor of the parliament. This is the latest in a series of protests over corruption, unemployment, and diplomatic agreements that the government has struck with neighbors Serbia and Montenegro. In the past, the opposition has used pepper spray, they've blown whistles, thrown water bottles, and I guess they're reaching desperate straits. The Supreme Court of Maryland has put a halt to all of the trials of Baltimore police officers who've been charged in the death of Freddie Gray. And I actually think this is a sensible move, because when the hung jury could not reach a decision in the case of Officer William Porter, who went to trial first, the judge set a new trial for Porter, but there are other cases that will come up in the meantime where the judge is going to require Officer Porter to testify, and that could compromise his Fifth Amendment right to self-incrimination. So they're going to have to sort through that and decide what order the cases will be handled in and what kinds of testimony will be permitted. In Kentucky, maybe we should call this Kim's Law. You remember the county clerk, Kim Davis? I think she's married four times or something like that. She refused to marry same-sex couples, despite the Supreme Court decision last year, and grandstanded for Christian consumption on that issue. So the state Senate in Kentucky approved a bill on Wednesday that would create a separate marriage license application for gay couples and straights. The straight marriage license application would list bride and groom positions, and the one for non-straights would list a first party and a second party. Now, on the face of it, this seems harmless, but it is separate but equal. And that was struck down by the Supreme Court when it was applied to race relations. So the American Civil Liberties Union of Kentucky issued a statement. Separate forms for gay and lesbian Kentuckians constitute unequal treatment under the law. Pure and simple, this bill is motivated by the desire to accommodate discrimination against same-sex couples. And I think that's accurate. In Canada, the new Trudeau administration has announced that it will no longer appeal the case of Omar Khadr. He was the teenager who was sent to Guantanamo, and his only way out was to give a confession, which he did. Then he was sent to Canada, where he was supposed to be immediately released, but they held him in prison for over a year. Then he was released on bail, but with high restrictions. He can only travel to visit family, only with his lawyer with him, only when he speaks English. He has to wear a monitoring bracelet on his ankle. And they have lifted the monitoring of his school computer. And this is an important case because Omar Khadr was in Afghanistan with his jihadist father, and he was accused of killing an American named Christopher Speer. But the case is riddled with confused testimony. The U.S. tried to make this into a kind of super crime, And there are serious questions about whether the wounded young man was even physically capable of killing Speer in the manner that he was accused of. And I hope that someday all of this will be over for Omar Khadr. I respect my listeners, and I appreciate critical, thoughtful emails from people who disagree with me. And Ian Berman dropped me a note about something I said last week on Thursday about Alan Grayson, the congressman from Florida, candidate for the U.S. Senate, and a New York Times story reported that he had set up his own hedge fund. And Ian takes me to task. He said, "I've never heard you so off in your commentary, and I think you owe an apology and a retraction to Alan Grayson." And the issue is that he set up this hedge fund, and Ian took the implication that I think Grayson is not progressive because he has a net worth of $10 million and that he invested in a family-run hedge fund. Well, the issue was that he was attempting to bring in other investors. He did not, in fact, but he was attempting to, and the marketing materials were parlaying his status as a member of Congress and his world travels, some of which were paid for by the American people in his role as a member of Congress. Now, it's important to note that Grayson served in the House from 2008 to 2010. He lost in 10, and then he came. Do I have that right? Anyway, he sat out one term after he lost an election due to redistricting. So it would have been in 12 that he lost, and then he returned in 14. So, during that time when he was out of office, he was running the hedge fund and going around the globe promoting it. And one of the things that I mentioned is that he was focused on disaster investing. And Ian writes, "Distressed investing has been around for over a century. It's nothing new but requires specific knowledge and a high-risk appetite." Now, I do understand that, but the distressed investing that was described in Grayson's marketing materials in many ways was chasing disasters, government failures, and unrest. And I have a hard time promoting the idea of making money off the misery of other people. And I don't think that is progressive. So Ian says, in short, "There's nothing wrong with distressed investing, but you use it as a smear on Grayson. In addition, you conflate the workers on a Grayson campaign raising money for this legitimate investment activity with his campaign activity." Well, what I cited was commentary from a campaign worker who was also hired by the hedge fund, who was advising Grayson to close it down because of the political implications of it. Ian writes, "There's nothing wrong with that either, absent any evidence of shady dealings, of which you provided none. Campaign workers don't have to give up other jobs, so you're putting together the two, absent any evidence, is merely an unsupported smear." And finally, briefly, you mentioned the Republicans are investigating Grayson. Really? A shocking turn of events. Well, I take your points, Ian, and on that basis, I will apologize to Alan Grayson. I still think that what he did and the way he has handled this is pretty lame, and it undercuts his position as a firebrand progressive from Florida. Couple of quickies before you have sex this weekend. In New York, a study of 283 LGBT youth who sell their bodies for what is known as survival sex. So these are rent boys and girls, I guess, to some extent. And what they figured out is that 99% said that they use protection against sexually transmitted infection in pregnancy, but only 63% say they use it all the time. Some said they wouldn't use condoms because they trusted their regular clients. They were coerced or forced not to use them. And in some cases, they got paid more for bareback sex. That's what it's called. So that's an interesting study on sex workers in New York. And here in California yesterday, there was a panel hearing held by the Division of Occupational Safety and Health looking into working conditions in the porn industry. And there have been regulations proposed to require porn actors not only to wear condoms, but also to wear goggles during oral sex scenes and dental dams. And I do understand the desire to prevent the transmission of infectious diseases. But I would argue that inserting a dental dam into an oral sex exchange is pretty complicated and probably doesn't work in a porn film. Now, certainly the interests of making X-rated films should be, a lower priority than the health of the actors who work there. But the industry argues that they test the actors every 14 days. If somebody's HIV positive, they're not allowed to work anymore. And they don't really address other sexually transmitted diseases. And in defending the proposed regulations, Ged Kinsley, a spokesman for the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, said, "Our goal is for condom use for vaginal and oral sex. We've never been looking for goggles or dental dams for oral sex." And, you know, I'm not a prude. I occasionally look at porn films. And I've seen some where the male actors have a condom on. I don't think that's a big deal. But the industry basically threatened to move porn production out of California if the state insisted on these levels of protective and safe sex techniques. Let me know what you think. You can drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. Thanks for listening to my news and comment, and please share this podcast far and wide. I'd appreciate it.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.